Good morning. My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And I want to welcome you to this discussion of Iraq, our politics beginning to move. Let me ask all of you to turn off your cell phones. Unlike many other events where I merely moderate, I'm going to start this one by working a little bit harder and saying a few words as a presenter. Then we'll proceed to Randall Rahim, my travel companion in Baghdad. And if you want to travel to Iraq, I can think of nobody better to travel with than Rand. Jason Gluck, who has only recently joined the Institute, having spent a year and a half with the United Nations in Baghdad, where he was concerned with legal issues and in particular constitutional questions. A few words that are derived largely from a peace briefing that we've already published and that's on the table outside. If you want a more formal version, a more detailed version, probably a slightly better version, go to that. But let me start off by giving you an idea of what Rend and I found during a mid-January trip to Baghdad. We went with the explicit intent of investigating why there was deadlock. It seemed to us from this vantage point, and I confess that to some people it still seems, that politics are completely deadlocked in Baghdad. That's not what we found. We found an unexpected degree of fluidity in the political system. And I hasten to add that this is not necessarily good. Fluids generally run downhill. It takes a certain effort to make them run uphill. But it is a necessary prelude to progress in Iraq, this kind of fluidity. The Kurdish Shia coalition is fraying. It hasn't fallen apart exactly, but it certainly is fraying. It was that coalition that really wrote the constitution and that underpins the current government. So this, we found a good deal less polarization, I would say, than we anticipated. But nothing fixed was yet emerging at the time. I think Rend will talk a little bit more about what might emerge. We found, you know, Sunni and Kurds making common cause after a fashion on Kirkuk, at least reaching an accommodation on the question of not holding the referendum. We found Shia and Sunni political forces arguing for a stronger central government, especially in the management of oil and oil revenue, which are two separate issues in Iraq. We found considerable unity among the Arab political leadership in a feeling that the Kurds are overstepping, that they are that their territorial ambitions extend significantly beyond Kirkuk, and I would say there's considerable resentment of that, of those territorial claims. We found a weakening of support for the nine-province southern region. Weakening of support isn't exactly the right way to put it. What we found was that there were people in the southern provinces who have some very different ideas about what kind of region you would have in the south, in particular people from Basra, who felt that Basra should have its own four-province region in the south, and that a nine-province southern region would not give sufficient due to Basra and its oil resources. We found some emergence of support for what Americans sometimes call Arabistan, that is a one giant region that encompasses all of Iraq outside of Kurdistan. So a lot of fluidity, a lot of thinking and rethinking, a lot of new voices emerging, and a good deal less polarization than we had anticipated. We also found some limited areas of very basic agreement. Iraqis all believe, so far as I can tell, that the issue among them is power and not religion. Actually, the term Sunni and Shia rarely arise in talking with Iraqi political leaders. The constitutional framework, though not ideal, Iraqis generally believe it should be respected, with each group, of course, emphasizing the provisions it favors as the ones that should be most respected. But the constitutional regime is definitely the frame of reference for the political leadership at this point. And I hasten to add that we did meet with Sadras, we did meet with people from the Sahwa, so this extended through a fairly broad part of the political spectrum. We did not meet with current insurgents. The politicians all also agreed, for the most part, in fact, I think entirely, that the population is fed up with sectarian talk and fighting, that the population wants them to stop and start delivering services, and that the population is far ahead of the political leadership in the reconciliation process, which I think everybody would prefer to call accommodation process by now. It hasn't been formally changed yet, but I think everybody agrees that it's more accommodation than reconciliation. There was also some basic agreement that government at the provincial level might be more important than people had imagined a year or two ago. The idea, the provinces under Saddam were not independent actors. Needless to say, they were not places where important decisions were made. That the attitude towards the provinces is changing significantly, and this is one of the great successes, I think, of the provincial reconstruction teams, which went out there without all that much of a clear purpose, but found one in the effort to push money from the central government to the provinces and then out to projects. And hundreds of millions of dollars are now flowing through the provincial councils. And this is making Iraqi politicians sit up and pay a little bit of attention. And the notion that the provinces might be quite important, and that the provincial elections in particular might be quite important, is on the upswing. All that said, there's clearly no new broad political compact on the shape of the state, leading to a real struggle with every piece of legislation, because every piece of legislation in some way can be seen as a constitutional question, and so thus the difficulty in passing legislation. But I hasten to add that Iraqi priorities are not legislative. Now, this shouldn't surprise us a whole lot. The rule of law was not very important in recent decades in Iraq, and I think people there are having trouble understanding, in fact, why the Americans are so keyed up about laws. And they're rather bemused by, if I may say so, by our embassy, which duns them constantly on why don't you pass this, why is this stuck, why is that stuck. Iraqi priorities are not legislative. What they want, it seems to me, and there's wide agreement on a lot of these things, they want returns. That is, return of displaced people and refugees, each group, of course, preferring the return of its own. They want jobs, in particular for the Sahwa. Why do they want jobs for the Sahwa? Well, the motives differ a little bit. I think on the Sunni side of the political spectrum, there's a feeling that these people deserve jobs. You know, they merit it. They fought against Al-Qaeda. You've got to reward them. On the Shia side, there's a feeling we got to disband this thing. It's growing and it's dangerous. We better find some jobs for these people. Iraqi priorities also include services, economic development, and, as I mentioned before, provincial elections, though a lot of us will anticipate, though I haven't seen clear evidence of it, will anticipate that ISKI, the former Supreme Council, will not be all that happy to have provincial elections because they are overrepresented in the current provincial councils and stand to lose a good deal of political terrain if the Sadras and Sunni political parties, including the Sahwa, if they participate in provincial elections. We didn't find people nervous about oil distribution, that is, oil revenue distribution. This was a little bit of a surprise to me. I'd heard from very knowledgeable people in Washington, D.C., that surely the Sunnis were extremely nervous to get the revenue distribution established in law. That is not what we found. We found that they were quite confident that oil revenue would be distributed among the provinces according to population. They're not nervous about that. That's been well respected on all sides. What they're concerned about is how much revenue will go to Baghdad relative to the provinces, and they're concerned about the issue of foreign participation in the oil sector. And needless to say, some of the concerns are not congruent with American concerns. Let's put it that way. Some new mechanisms have emerged to manage political issues in Iraq. There's an executive council, the president, the vice president, the prime minister. The prime minister says the executive council is entirely advisory in character. The others have insisted on calling it an executive council. There's clearly a little bit of dissonance there. There's something called the Committee of Five, which are aides to the Executive Council, plus a representative of the Kurdistan Regional Government. And these institutions, it's a little bit unclear to me how they're functioning today, but they certainly were of some importance in the preparation of the de-ba'athification law, for example. And my sense is that what they're trying to do, and maybe learning to do quite effectively, is to manage political issues before they get to the parliament, and that's perhaps not the worst thing I've ever heard. That said, the institutions are still extraordinarily weak. The ministers, a lot of ministers are missing. I didn't count today, but last I heard there were 11 ministers missing from the government. The reconstitution of government that should have occurred last month still has not occurred. The laws that govern the ministries are missing. The cabinet gets failing grades from just about everybody. The prime minister is clearly pleased to have survived two attempts to remove him, one last summer and one in December. He's held on to power, but he's less than clear about what he wants to do with it. And that's a problem in many post-conflict situations. It's not unique to Iraq. On top of some weakness in the institutions, in the government program, there are enormous challenges ahead that would challenge even a very well-established government. There's the question of government reconstitution, reshuffle, whatever you want to call it, which hasn't happened and which requires some agreement among the political parties. Clearly, they're having trouble getting to it. There's the question of the Sadr's ceasefire and whether it will be renewed this month. Non-renewal, obviously, would be a big problem because it could reignite some sectarian fighting. and it would be a big challenge for the Americans, needless to say, as well. If they're to meet the schedule for provincial elections that they've set out for themselves, which is to either begin holding them or finish holding them by October 1st, but in any case, whatever it is, they need a new electoral law in March. We found some broad agreement on the question of changing the electoral law so that it allows an open list system. That's all to the good. I think the UN, I'm told, is supporting that as well. That's all to the good. But the problem, of course, is that organizing an election, especially one in which there are displaced people and refugees who want to vote in their home community, organizing an election with an open list system under those conditions is a very, very complicated thing to do. If they do it on a rolling basis, in some ways it limits the complications in country, but it makes the voting from abroad and from displaced people even more complicated. It's going to be a big challenge to hold provincial elections, to get a provincial elections law, a new one, and to hold the elections this year. In April, the moratorium on region formation ends, and ISKI could begin the process of referenda in the provinces on whether they want to join a 9-province southern region. The threshold for posing referendum questions is exceedingly low. But at the same time, it's not going to be only the 9-province southern region that's voted on. It seems very likely that there will be other propositions that people will put forward. By June, if you don't see a lot of the people in the Sahuat, if you don't see them incorporated somehow, partly 20% are supposed to go to security forces, others are supposed to get other jobs or job training. If you don't see some progress on that by June, I think you got a bit of trouble. By July, they're supposed to have completed a negotiation with the United States, providing them with full sovereignty. Now, here just a quick word that reflects on us as well as on them. I mean, the American objective in these negotiations will be to maintain our soldiers under American jurisdiction so far as any misbehavior is concerned. This is standard American policy every place in the world. It is true, as some point out, that we waive our jurisdiction occasionally to allow somebody who's committed a particularly egregious crime in Okinawa to be tried in Okinawa, but the principle is the same. We have first dibs on people who do the wrong thing. The Iraqi objective in these negotiations is precisely the opposite of that. Their motive is to establish full sovereignty over both private security companies and the American troops on the ground in Iraq. And these are political imperatives for not just, these aren't just words, these are real imperatives for their parliament and for our Congress. And how you reconcile those two perspectives by July, I frankly don't know. And if you don't, you then have to proceed with renewing a UN Security Council resolution, which would be a real retreat for the Iraqi government, and they won't want to do it. Just to wrap up, the Iraqis made it pretty clear right across the political spectrum that they don't want an immediate withdrawal of American troops. They want us to fix it before we leave. At the same time, they would welcome, and I think this is true across the political spectrum too, a time horizon for the U.S. military presence. Some even said, we'd like a little conditionality to try to force us to do the right things. So better security has led towards moderation. I think the time has come for us to allow the Iraqis to lead on priorities rather than follow. In that sense, I think the future benchmarks should be more theirs and less ours. Beyond that, I'm not going to talk about the future. Rend will talk about that more, and then Jason will talk about the legislative accomplishments to date and what they really mean. Rand?
You can speak from there if the camera says you can.
Thank you, Dan. Before I go into the future prospects and what I see are markers for us to look at in the coming several months, I want to add one note just to sort of cap what Dan has said, and that is that as these large alliances of Tawafuq and UIA started breaking down, what we saw on our trip is that the political parties in Iraq, or the political groups, if you want to call them, are really acting as political parties. And they are acting out of the interest of their political party, not necessarily out of the interest of the grander coalition of parties in which they entered parliament, but on a much more local basis, much more fragmented, yes, but really a more realistic basis of self-interest. And this is the emergence of real politics in Iraq. We hadn't seen that up until now. The issues were much more broadly framed, much more framed in sectarian terms. This time round, we did see something that looked like politics as we would recognize it. So this was a very interesting observation, and I think a real departure. We will, I believe, see much more of that, given that we are anticipating provincial elections towards the end of the year. And we will see more party politicking, probably verging into some sort of violence or conflict. I'll come to that in a minute. So there are good elements in that, but there are also some negatives that might emerge. Having said that, I don't want anybody to go away with the idea that it's a very rosy picture in Iraq, and being an eternal pessimist, I will now talk about what I think are problems. First of all, yes, the larger coalitions of Tawafuq and UIA are disintegrating or have done so. Does that mean that the Sunni-Shia divide has eroded in Iraq? Absolutely not. Although you do get shifting alliances, and these alliances now can be cross-sectarian, you do have, and cross-ethnic. For example, you do have the IIP signing an agreement with the Kurds, you do have the Sadris and some from the Tawafuq going to Maliki and endorsing his policies. So you do get these cross-sectarian, cross-ethnic alliances, but they're all very tactical, they're not really strategic. We have not yet seen the emergence of a national platform or several national platforms that could really bridge the Sunni-Shia divide in a real way, in a substantial way. And let me explain a little bit what I mean by that. Although we now have many Shia parties and they don't all agree, the Sadris and the Iski and the Fadila certainly don't agree with each other and come to blows frequently, yet each one of them is actually representing only their sect and aspire to be the spokesperson for their sect rather than the spokesperson for the entire country. It's very similar on the Sunni side. They still talk, the IIP, other members of the Tawafuq, now the Sahwa, who have emerged, also speak in terms of their sectarian interest as opposed to a national interest, with a small caveat, and that is that the Sahwa people from Anbar that we spoke to did aspire to speak on a national level. And this was very striking. It was quite different from what we heard from the IIP or the Sadris or ISKI. Suddenly you had people who said, we are speaking on behalf of Iraq. We want to knit the Shia and the Sunnis together. We are extending lines of communication into the south, into Nineveh. We want to create this, we want to weave something across Iraq that is not Sunni nor Shia. And that was really quite an exception to what we saw this time, and what we had seen, what I had seen certainly in the past on my visits. So the Sunni-Shia divide is still there. The alliances that we're seeing are tactical rather than strategic. For example, and again to push this line a little bit, we did not see any strategic alliances on what I would consider the major issues that are outstanding in Iraq, and that is the shape of the state, what kind of federalism is going to exist, is it a strong federalism, is it a weak federalism, what is, how strong is the central government. Now, clearly there are, this is defined in the Constitution, it has been revisited by the Constitutional Review Committee, and in fact the national government has been given more authorities, as perhaps Jason will tell us. Nevertheless, there is still a question about the real strength of the national government, and I don't see any agreement on that between the Sunni or Shia, and or between the Shia themselves or the Sunnis themselves. The Sunnis tend to agree a little bit more, but there is a lot of dissension on the central issues. The other central issue which there is no agreement on is the issue of power sharing. How do you share power in what all parties, sects, and ethnicities will regard as, if not a totally fair, at least an acceptable mechanism, an acceptable proportionality. These issues are still very outstanding. The point about the mechanisms that Dan mentioned, we do have the Executive Council. There is disagreement about its authorities, and we will wait to see whether that Executive Council is going to survive and is going to be effective. It was created for two reasons. One of them is that the Presidential Council felt that Maliki was taking decisions unilaterally, that he was not consulting with anyone or not consulting sufficiently, and that the Presidential Council, which represented the unity of the major, three major groups in Iraq, the Kurds, the Shia, and the Sunnis, really, because it had that representational element in it, should be much more involved in major strategic decision-making, and Maliki was not giving them the authority. Maliki's response was, if you look at the Constitution, the Presidential Council really doesn't have those authorities. In the end, Maliki was persuaded that the Presidential Council needed to have a say. The other reason the Executive Committee or the Executive Council was created was because Maliki and Tariq al-Hashmi simply were incapable of sitting together for more than 10 minutes without coming to blows, figuratively speaking. This was a mechanism to bring them together with a form of mediation by Jalal Talabani and Adil Abdel Mahdi so that they could resolve issues of disagreement. It is, in fact, a very good mechanism. If it survives and if it lasts, there are tensions within it already, and I heard of such tensions before I left, and very discreetly spoken to me. I don't know what will happen, but hopefully it will continue. The other important mechanism is this Committee of Five, which is supposed to be a problem-solving committee, so that on an executive level, or on a policy-making level rather, the five major components of the Iraqi state, the Presidential Council, Maliki, as well as the Kurdish regional government, could agree on major policy matters and major legislative issues before they went to Parliament, so that when they get to Parliament, there is a realistic likelihood of the passage of legislation and of resolution of decision-making mechanisms. The trouble with those two mechanisms is that they necessarily include some people and exclude others. The Sadris are excluded from those two particular bodies. The other members of Tawafiq are not included. Importantly, the Sahwa, which is emerging as a very important political force, not just a military and security element, but as a political force, and they do see themselves as a political force, they are not included. Of course, Alawi's group is not included, although there are discussions about including them. But it does create a sense of some people are in and some people are out. And I don't know how that is going to work. There is another body that was created in 2006 called the Political Council for National Security. Much broader, it includes all the principal representatives of all the principal groups that are in Parliament, and I think it includes about 9 or 11 groups. That has been dysfunctional. There has been talk about activating it. That certainly would be a more inclusive body, but it would be at a lower level of decision making and policy making. So there are efforts to create these problem solving mechanisms, but we don't know to what extent they are going to be effective. There is now a law on provincial powers, and there is going to be, within 90 days, I understand, a law on provincial elections. So it appears that the government is now serious about holding political elections, provincial elections, even though, as Dan mentioned, some parties, not just the Supreme Council, by the way, but also IIP, may not be very keen because they already control a fair number of provincial councils, so they're not keen on elections. But we're going to go ahead anyway. And this raises really two issues. One of them is the question of having lost the sense of these big coalitions. If you remember in January 2005, when we had our first and only provincial elections, the UIA ran for provincial elections on one slate. The Sudris were not in that in any formal way, but there was one Shia slate represented by the UIA. Now that we have had this deconstruction of the larger groups, they are presumably going to run separately, and therefore the competition in the provincial elections is going to be fierce. My expectation is that there is going to be a good deal of violence in the south between the Sudris and the Supreme Council, and I expect the same to happen in the purely Sunni areas because of the competition between Sahwa and IIP, and even within the Sahwa there is going to may well be a breakdown of the unity that we have seen so far. So the provincial elections may be a cause of Shia-Shia violence, Sunni-Sunni violence in some of the provinces. The provinces to look out for specifically, I would say, are Baghdad, Basra, Anbar, and Nineveh, Mosul. This is a potential liability of the provincial elections. Now, once the provincial elections are held, it's going to be interesting to see how the political landscape changes, who is going to control what in the provinces, and therefore, what influence are they going to have on Baghdad? So far, the influence politically in Iraq has been from the center to the provinces. In other words, you know, Supreme Council has a very big role to play in the national government, and it has been able to influence the provinces politically and to control a large number of the provinces. If the elections in the provinces undermine the Supreme Council's control in the provincial elections, and in the outcome of the provincial elections, will that be reflected on a national basis in Baghdad? Are the dynamics between the center and the provinces going to be changed? Is it going to be reversed? Is it going to be more balanced? That is going to be a very interesting question, particularly as in 2009 we're supposed to have national elections. And so the outcome of the provincial elections may create reverberations that are unanticipated on a national level. The other issue that I want to mention, which is related to this one, is that there is really a serious danger, in my view, of ongoing conflict, Shia-Shia conflict, Shia on Shia conflict, Sunni on Sunni conflict, that we might see with or without the provincial elections. We are already seeing Muqtada al-Sadr threatening not to renew the ceasefire. Certainly there's pressure from the rank and file of the Sadris to abrogate the ceasefire because they claim that the Supreme Council and the government, but in a sense it's a little difficult to disentangle the two. The Supreme Council is in many ways the government, that they have not kept their side of the bargain. There was a bargain struck between Muqtada al-Sadr and Abdulaziz al-Hakim in October in Tehran specifically, and it was as a consequence of the ceasefire. It didn't lead to the ceasefire. The ceasefire actually antedated that, but the agreement did stipulate certain standards of conduct between the two, and the Sadris claim that the Supreme Council hasn't kept up their side of the bargain, so there's pressure on Muqtada to release his followers from that bargain, from the ceasefire. If that happens, and if we continue to see dissension in Anbar within the Sahwa, and indeed the Sahwa extends, by the way, to the concerned local citizens group in Baghdad, there is an attempt to take over the local citizens groups, the concerned local citizens groups, by a number of parties in Anbar or parties in Baghdad. So we're getting to see polarization even within the Sunni ranks. So that could lead to some more violence, and that is an issue that we really should look out for. I wanted to talk about some recommendations. I don't know if I have a minute. It seems to me that two things that I would want to focus on. One of them is that there has been an emphasis on strengthening the provinces, the provincial councils, and so on, and a certain level of disenchantment and almost veering on despair with the national government. I think this is wrong. I do not think we should strengthen the provincial governments at the expense of the national government. This is an issue that we should be able to walk and chew gum. We should be able to strengthen the provincial governments, and I think we're doing a reasonably good job in some governorates. I wouldn't agree with Dan that it's universal. I think it's selective. But I think there has been an abandonment virtually of the national government and a desire and a drive by the U.S. to strengthen the national government. It seems to me there's a certain level of washing your hands of this. I think that is extremely dangerous. And I want to draw everybody's attention to something which happened today, which is, and I don't know if it's been in the press, I saw it in the Arabic press, that it apparently, the campaign in Mosul has been building up for the last month. Well, it appears it has to be postponed because Maliki cannot send enough Iraqi troops to Mosul to fight the Qaeda. This is, if anything, indicates the necessity of strengthening the capacities of the national government. It is an event like this which tells us that we do not have an option but to create a functional, capable national government. And as part of this, my second recommendation is that we need to emphasize, rather than insisting on benchmarks which are this law and that law, I think what we should be emphasizing are benchmarks of performance of the executive branch in Iraq. Put pressure on them to deliver services, because really the Iraqi people are fed up with politics and want to see their government deliver something to them. The government has lost credibility with the people in a massive way. And I saw this in July, I saw this again this time, and if we are, as we seem to be, supporting this government to the bitter end, then we should try and bolster its ability to connect again with the people and to gain credibility. Thank you.
Thank you, Ren. Jason?
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Ren. Am I okay here, or should I move up to the...
As you like, Jason.
Okay. That's fine. So we've heard a great deal about the political climate in Iraq, and it would be an understatement to say that there are some significant challenges ahead for the Iraqis. But I have what I consider the enviable task of talking about a rare political success, and that was the recent passage of three pieces of legislation: the Provincial Powers Law, the amnesty law and the budget by the Council of Representatives. And so over the next couple of minutes, without getting too far into the weeds of, on any of these individual pieces of legislation, I'd like to talk about the laws themselves, the political compromises that led to their passage, and then what they could mean individually and collectively for broader national reconciliation or accommodation going forward in Iraq. And I'll start with the Provincial Powers Law. It is the one that I think has the most extensive constitutional implications and probably the greatest impact on politics in Iraq and the structure of the state. And here we need to distinguish between a few different subnational entities, because of course when we speak about politics and power sharing in Iraq, what we're talking about is the degree of centralization or decentralization. And we know that under the Saddam regime, it was highly centralized. And all of the 18 provinces, including those that today exist as Iraqi Kurdistan, were mere administrative units of the central government. In contrast, today, under the 2005 Constitution, we still have a central government, significantly weaker than it was before, but we have two different strata of subnational units. We have the regions, of which today there is only one, and that is Iraqi Kurdistan, and we have 15 provinces, or also called governorates. And it's important to understand the distinction between them because the political interests in Iraq are actually very different in terms of whether they favor decentralization or the extent to which they favor decentralization, depending on which level of government we're talking about. The Kurds are pretty consistent. They favor a high degree of decentralization for the regions and I think also for the provinces themselves, although even there they have conflicting interests. The Shia and the Sunni, however, are very different in that, and we saw this in the Constitutional Review, they pressed very hard for greater centralization vis-a-vis Baghdad and the regions. They feel that the powers are highly devolved, that the regions not only possess all reserved powers, and there are only, depending on how you count it, about a dozen or so exclusively federal powers spelled out in the Constitution. All other powers, unless they're shared, are reserved for the regions, and even those that are shared, the regions enjoy legislative priority such that in the event there's a conflict between national and regional law, the regional law prevails. And we saw this during the discussion over the hydrocarbon legislation, where not only was there difference of opinion on what the national law should say, there was an underlying concern that even if they passed the perfect national legislation, Kurdistan could pass conflicting legislation either with regard to the management of oil or the treatment of hydrocarbon revenue, and that legislation would actually prevail over whatever was passed by the Council of Representatives. So there is a great deal of concern on the part of the Shia and Sunni to bring back some of that power to the central government. It's very different when we're talking about the provinces, because even under the 2005 Constitution, or at least the treatment of the provinces since 2003, they have remained largely administrative units of the central government. And here the Constitution is not very helpful. It is at best ambiguous as to what are the powers of the provinces, and at worst contradictory. And this issue has highly impeded the passage of the Provincial Powers Law. In fact, this past summer, when the law was debated in Parliament, the debate had to be suspended so that it could be pulled back into committee and, in fact, have an advisory opinion rendered by the Federal Supreme Court on exactly what the Constitution says vis-a-vis the powers of the provinces. So this law has been over a year in the making, and it's had a lot of hands on it. And what was passed, unfortunately, last week, does very little to shed light on this fundamental constitutional question. What we see is a provincial power law that potentially expands the power of the provinces. There is no question that it grants some legislative authority, although the scope of that authority is questionable. There is executive power, and there is some quasi-judicial power, although that is at best unclear in the law itself. The governorates have the power to supervise or oversee most public facilities in the governorate, despite the fact that they'll still be managed by the federal ministries. They have certain police powers, and they can raise their own money, including a limited tax power. And here this is interesting because the Constitution actually does not provide a tax power for the federal government, and yet this law provides limited tax power to the provinces subject to federal law. And I think what we see here is sort of an evolving process whereby what we have is a constitutional review that was begun in earnest in 2007, suspended temporarily in the middle of 2007, and what we have are a list of proposed recommendations for amendments to the Constitution, one of which is to provide the federal government with a tax power. And I think what we see here is a piece of legislation that is trying to accommodate what the parliamentarians see as future amendments to the Constitution, although for obvious reasons that's a bit problematic. The governorates will have some power over their own budget, although most of their revenue will still come from disbursements from the federal government. And this legislative power, even to the extent that it's it is vague, but it seems to limit or exclude certain areas that we would typically expect to be within the province of local government, specifically healthcare and education. So clearly these are still going to be units of government with far less powers than the regions, and yet we don't know exactly what those powers will be. And I don't think we will until we start to see the provinces themselves start to assert themselves. Let me just say that the language in the law itself carves out legislative authority for the provinces for the purpose of local ordinances pursuant with constitutional language that speaks to administrative decentralization, itself undefined, but then says that none of these laws should contradict the Constitution or federal legislation. So the central government has sort of left itself this catch-all to allow the provinces to grow legislatively, administratively, but to be able to rein them in the event the central government views that they've overstepped their bounds. Another crucial point to this law that is in the same vein is the fact that the central government has retained the right to dismiss even the highest levels of provincial officials, including the governor, and in fact, under some circumstances, dissolve the provincial council itself. So there is an informal mechanism as well to try and keep control over local administration and local legislation. And again, we just won't know the extent to which this is going to, where the balance will be struck until this law is effectuated. The other interesting political dynamic to this law is that it has profound ramifications for region formation itself. And Dan alluded, and Rend as well, alluded to the fact that we are mere weeks, a couple months away from the green light for provinces to begin region formation. This is an extremely contentious issue in Iraq, particularly for the Sunnis who fear this nine-governorate Shiistan and what that could mean for fragmentation of Iraq as a whole. It is an extremely contentious issue for some Shia, particularly the Sadrists and the Fadila party, who fear control of all of the nine Shia, predominantly Shia provinces from Najaf at the expense of Basra. And I think that you can't deny that this also played a role in striking the balance of the power of the provinces. To the extent the provinces have greater power, it will undercut the motivation for them to form regions. And this, I think, is particularly in the interests of, as I said, the Sadrists, the Fadila, the secularist Alawi party, the Sunni parties. To the extent the provinces have lesser power, this will bolster the motivation to form a region, which I believe not only ISKI, but the Kurds could favor as well. Another issue that was paramount in the negotiation over the final passage of the law was the presence of a deadline for elections, but I believe Dan and Rend spoke to this quite thoroughly. I'll simply say that the election provision is in the law. There is a call for an electoral law that will spell out the exact mechanisms for the elections within 90 days of approval of the Provincial Powers Law. And I was doing some math in my head the UN has voiced support for the October deadline. They've also expressed that logistically they're going to need, you know, 6 months before an election is possible. 6 months from October 1st is somewhere in the March timeframe. 90 days from the approval of this law goes beyond the March timeframe, and frankly, the Council of Representatives is in recess until March 18th anyway. So I don't know the likelihood of getting this law in time, but this will obviously be yet one more very fluid situation in terms of holding the Iraq the elections by deadline. What does this mean in terms of broader national reconciliation, and is it a step forward? I think the letter of the law, absolutely yes. The devil is always in the details, and in Iraq even more than the details, the implementation. And here, I think, for the reasons that I've already alluded to, there's a great deal of uncertainty as to how this will be implemented. Certainly the addition of the electoral deadline, I consider a positive development, again, for reasons that I've already been spoken to, but I think that on the provincial level, many of these councils are not representative of the current political dynamics in Iraq, and I think this is necessary. On the amnesty law, there are currently about 26,000 people detained in Iraqi prisons. There's almost an equal number detained in American prisons in Iraq, although this law probably does not apply to them. Of the 26,000 detained in Iraqi prisons, about 80% are Sunni, and in the view of the Sunni, most of them were in the wrong place at the wrong time, or are the victims of political and sectarian bias. This was, for therefore pretty clear reasons, a central demand of the Sunni parties, not only in terms of what ultimately became a package of three pieces of legislation, but has been a central demand in the return of Sunni ministers to the central government. And again here, what we have is a law that I think on its face is very positive, but implementation will be the key. And it is a limited amnesty that applies to all Iraqis who have been sentenced, and those who have been detained for 6 months or more without being charged, or what is the Iraqi equivalent of being charged. In Iraq, you actually go in front of an administrative judge, and constitutionally that's supposed to happen within 48 hours of being arrested. In practice, the capacity of the courts is taxed to such a great extent that some people have been sitting in jail for 6 months or a year without even getting this fundamental due process. So all of those detained who have not even seen an administrative judge in 6 months are released. All of those who have been sentenced are released, subject to a extensive list of exceptions. And these exceptions are common crimes, murder, rape, aggravated theft, but also some broader or potentially broader crimes like terrorism or war crimes. And it remains to be seen how this law will be implemented, such that will many of these Sunnis who arguably could have been arrested or even sentenced for these crimes of terrorism or war crimes, what percentage of them will be released? And this will have a huge impact on the extent to which this law will move forward the political process and advance reconciliation and accommodation. The other X factor in all this will be the capacity of the courts to actually implement the law itself. And here, I'm encouraged by the fact that this has been taxed to the Higher Judicial Council. It is seen by Iraq as a largely neutral and fair tribunal. But again, it is within the Iraqi courts, and capacity will be the key. I think that we will need to see a release of significant numbers of prisoners in the 3 month range, the 6 month range. Beyond that, if you get to the 12 month range, I think the value that this law could provide politically will largely be lost. For reasons that I already said, it's very difficult to predict how many people will actually be released pursuant to the amnesty. The State Department figures that I've heard are somewhere in the 8,000 to 12,000 person range, and that applies to the 26,000 that are being held in Iraqi prisons to date. The final law of this package of three was the budget. And this is obviously immensely important for just the practical considerations of the continuum functioning of state. But here, this was the law that the Kurds put the most stock in. And for them, the key issue was the allocation to the Kurdistan region. They have last year and traditionally gotten 17%. It is commonly believed, particularly among the Sunni and the Shia, that this overstates their proportional percentage, their population percentage, and that is actually closer to 14%, and this was the major fight. In the end, the Kurds did get the 17%. It is good for the following year and will be revisited at that time pursuant to a call for a census, which itself will be filled with politics and will have broad implications, not just for budget allocations, but for things like provincial elections and referendum on disputed territories, most notably Kirkuk. The other issue in the budget, particularly of interest to the Kurds, was who was going to pay for the National Guard, or in the case of Kurdistan, the Peshmerga. Historically, this has been paid out of the coffers of the federal government after the 17% allocation to the Kurdistan region. They obviously want that to continue to be the case. In true political fashion, the question was not resolved by the law itself, but there is a provision that the Prime Minister will enter into negotiations with the KRG to resolve this question. The last interesting thing that I would note on, two more points of interest on the budget. One is where this 17% comes from, because the future state of Iraq is, of course, unknown. Right now, you have these provinces, and there's no question that they get their allocation from the federal government. However, as we see with Kurdistan, the regions have this higher status and negotiate their percentage into the budget itself. Now, regardless of whether you consider Kurdistan or the region to encompass 17 or 14% of the population at large, it should become immediately apparent that were the rest of Iraq to form regions and get equal treatment to that Kurdistan enjoys today, you could not apportion the budget based on the percentage in the governor in the provinces themselves, giving a percentage to each province based on their population, and have much, if anything, left over for the federal government to continue to function. And here, I think, again, it just underscores what has been one of, in my view, the glaring weaknesses of the Constitution itself, which is to reconcile what is the ultimate structure of Iraq going to look like. And then to distribute, whether we're talking about revenue or distribution of powers, so that you can have a functional federal state. The final point I'll make on the budget is that the federal allotments to the provinces were increased by, on average, about 50% from 2007. And I think this underscores a commitment on the part of both the Americans, but also the Iraqis, to embolden the provinces and to work from the bottom up in building capacity. And I consider this a positive development, although I would agree with Rend, it should not be at the expense of the federal government. So, aside from the individual pieces of legislation themselves, what did we see on February 13th, and what does it mean for politics in Iraq? First of all, it was a major event just to pass these three laws. In each one of them went through its own travails in getting to the point where they were ready to be passed, but collectively, over the week prior to passage, there was enormous trouble to focus on any one piece of legislation at a time. A week prior to the ultimate passage, there was the amnesty law was one article away from being read, receiving its third reading, which would have been the prelude to passage. And the Kurds objected immediately, believing that if the amnesty law were to pass before the budget, the Sunnis could then walk out, they will have gotten what they cared most about, walked out of Parliament, and prevented quorum and the ability of Parliament to pass the budget. On the eve of, February 12th, the budget was this close to being passed, and we saw Sunni and Shia parliamentarians storm out of Parliament to preventing quorum so that that law couldn't be passed because they feared that once the Kurds got what they wanted, there wouldn't be a quorum necessary to pass the amnesty or the provincial powers law. So through some creative politicking, what happened last week was that they found a way to pass the three laws simultaneously. And I think on its face, this may not be a monumental event, but in the context of Iraqi politics, I think it's just that. The fact that they were both able to swap, get what they needed from their particular key legislation and give up something in return, and do so in a process that built the trust, or at least removed the impediments towards passing all three pieces of important legislation. What does this say going forward? I would say that the Iraqis have potentially found a map to deal with some of the other problems and challenges ahead of them. If you look at what will be what the U.S. considers, the remaining benchmark legislation, or some of the key initiatives in the eyes of the Iraqis, you have things like the constitutional review, which is still stalled, or you have strong Sunni and Shia agreement on what. A number of important constitutional amendments having to do with hydrocarbon treatment, revenue sharing, and distribution of powers, particularly, but Kurdish objection. You have a Kurdish priority in resolving the disputed territories, and most notably Kirkuk. And there you have, again, a fault line that runs largely along ethnic lines. And you have the hydrocarbon legislation. I think that there's absolutely potential for passing or resolving all three of these issues and others if the Iraqis decide are able to maintain sort of this atmosphere of political compromise and treat them in terms of a broad bargain rather than individual isolated events, which thus far has proven very difficult for them to resolve. And I think I'll hand it back to you, Dan.
Thank you, Jason. I'm going to ask people to line up at the microphone to ask questions. I see an extraordinary number of knowledgeable people in the room. I urge them to challenge us. And let me say that I think what you're hearing is that maybe the fluid is starting very slowly to move uphill. Not that everything is great, but some movement in the right direction. Jeff?
Thanks. I'm Jeff Friedman from the Council on Foreign Relations. Both Daniel and Rand mentioned that perhaps we focus too much on the laws and should look more at performance. I think that's probably right on the whole, but I'd like to follow up on that, because in some instances I think the relationship is a bit odd. In particular on oil, the Parliament is having a very difficult time passing this law, but as Daniel mentioned, in many ways, they're acting like it's already passed. They're distributing the revenues proportionally. So in some senses, we could say, focus on the performance. We could de facto check that box. They are cooperating. And yet you'd think, all things being equal, if they're going to do it anyway, why not write the law and get us off their backs? And I wonder, there are a couple different possibilities for this puzzle. One is that there are technical details holding this up. Non-substantive is difficult to pass laws, so we should focus on the performance. The other would be, well, perhaps the leadership is willing to experiment with accommodation but not commit themselves to it. And that would be a much more, much deeper problem that indicates how far the compromise has actually gone. So I'm wondering, on that issue, I get the sense that there's a similar dynamic on debathification. How satisfied can we be with performance rather than law?
Brent, do you want to try that one?
Well, I'll have a go. First of all, keep in mind that there are actually two laws that relate to oil. One of them is the hydrocarbon law, and that deals with contracting, exploration, production, etc. And the other one is the revenue sharing law. Now, they're clearly intimately tied because most of Iraq's revenue is from oil. And it's the revenue sharing that is functioning. That is the major one, and therefore the feeling is that since we are sharing the revenue in a way that is acceptable and so on, why hurry the hydrocarbon law, which does actually have some very important issues in it and matters of very serious and long-lasting differences, and the issues it raises are long-lasting. And I think the sense is that rather than have a fight over this law or pass a law that people aren't happy with, we should try and take our time over it. The other thing I would note is this. This is a little bit of an oversimplification, but look, the hydrocarbon law is very important for foreign companies to come in and invest and raise Iraq's production and what have you. Now Iraq is producing about 2.4 barrels a day, and they could increase it a little bit. The fact is that they can't even use all the revenue that they are getting from this level of production and export. The government is incapable, doesn't have the capacity to use up all the money it's already getting. And my question, I know this is a facile question, but my question is, which is more important today? Is it to help the government to increase its capacity and help it to spend the money it is already making on infrastructure projects, on services and so on? Or is it more important to intensify the squabble over the hydrocarbon law and insist on passing it as a benchmark? I think the first choice is the more important one right now.
David.
I'm David Mack, Middle East Institute. My question concerns the political role of the Kurds going forward. They've played their cards extraordinarily well, I would say, since 2003. You indicated, Dan, that there are signs that people feel they may have overreached. I'm wondering whether we're not at a juncture where they will appreciate that they have attained such a disproportionate share of influence in the federal government to their numbers, and most probably a disproportionately large part of the budget, that they will begin seeing a certain stake in a strong federal system of which they will be a part, rather than being pressured by popular sentiment in Iraqi Kurdistan to push for greater and greater separation from a central government in Baghdad that would wither away.
Well, maybe I should just say a word about this. There is certainly in the Kurdish political leadership an attachment to its position in the central government that is much greater than the support for a unified Iraq among the populace in Kurdistan. But I'm not sure I can applaud this disjunction between political leadership and populace. It seems to me a problem, actually, that there is this disjunction. And I don't know how it'll work itself out, to tell you the truth. It's, I think, a great deal depends, and I think one of the reasons the Kurds are insisting so much on signing contracts for exploration, I think a great deal depends on how much oil there is in Kurdistan, because, 17% of Iraq's oil might be a hell of a lot better than 100% of Kurdistan's oil, but you got to know what's there. Kirkuk is one of the oldest producing fields on Earth. We've heard people from this podium explain, oil experts, that it is declining extremely rapidly and cannot be restored without a tremendous expenditure of billions of dollars. It is unclear how much oil is in the rest of Kurdistan, and I think a great deal depends in the end on what the numbers turn out to be. In the meanwhile, you have to acknowledge that in particular President Talabani and Vice Prime Minister Barham Saleh have played an extraordinarily positive role
And the foreign minister.
In Baghdad, and the foreign minister, I would add. So it's a very confused picture, like a lot of other things in Iraq.
Do they, if I could just follow
up on that,
are they beginning to sense that they are going to be under rising pressure from Turkey and quite possibly face waning support from the United States over time?
Rand?
You leave me the difficult ones. Well, they are certainly under pressure from Turkey, although Masoud Barzani has been at pains lately to try and retract the rather rash statements he made about burning Diyarbakir and so on. And he was recently quoted as saying that he wanted good relations with Turkey, and that they have a lot of interest. Now, one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that I believe Turkey has invested something like $2.7 billion in Iraqi Kurdistan so far. And most of the foreign investment in Kurdistan is indeed from Turkey, and Turkish companies are heavily present. Now, this cuts both ways. It puts pressure on the Kurds, but it also puts some pressure on Turkey. From the U.S. side, one can only read the tea leaves by reading some of the articles that have recently appeared that indicate that the Kurds are not really as good allies and as reliable allies as we, the U.S., had always thought. And my assumption is that some of those articles at least represent or reflect a desire by the administration to raise a red flag for the Kurds. But interestingly, and alluded to this, I think the Kurds are also feeling a lot of pressure from the Arab side of Iraq. And they may be calculating that, well, we probably are overstepping the mark, we need to pull back a little bit, let's rein ourselves in. And that in the absence of a real choice for secession right now, they can't simply have everything their own way.
Thank you very much for a very interesting panel. I have two questions.
Faisal, introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Faisal Astarabadi. I'm a visiting professor of law at Indiana University in Bloomington. First question is, to what extent... There seem to have been some, there are at least some who are saying that the intra-party cohesion may be somewhat breaking down, so that the parliamentary blocks, the parliamentary parties are not sort of rubber stamping what their leaderships do in the Council of Ministers or elsewhere. So the first question is, to what extent do you find that to be the case or not? The second question has to do with the constitutional process, which has seems to me to be well underway, as we are planning for referenda here and there, and for provincial elections, and for the devolution of power to potentially new regions. But on the other hand, the constitution itself is theoretically still open to amendment. So that there are those who do not accept the terms of the Constitution and the extent of federalization. There is not a broad consensus on what federalism should look like in the country, and yet the political process is going forward for operating under the current Constitution, so that you have an inherent conflict, it seems to me, which tends towards greater instability. So rather than seeing these laws as success, it seems to me they're laying the foundation for more conflict, and I'd be interested in comments on that as well. Thank you.
Jason, you want to start on that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to what you're saying, and I think it is extremely problematic. While we know that, for example, the hydrocarbon legislation was held up over disagreement between the Shia and the Kurds on many substantive issues, the Sunni position throughout the entire negotiation was that there should be no hydrocarbon law at all until the Constitution is amended. And we saw, again, the uncertainty, the ambiguity, even the contradictions within the Constitution play a key role in debate over the provincial powers law. And I think we will see it again with region formation. all of these things, it is, I mean, fluidity is the absolute perfect word because all of these things are happening simultaneously. And you do have the potential for things to progress ahead of the constitutional review, which, again, I will just, is not on track right now for a referendum. There is a package of amendments that has been presented to the parliament that make, in my view, very important improvements to the Constitution, but regardless, very substantive changes, particularly with regard to the federal structure and relationship between the center and the regions. But within 48 hours of this package being presented to Parliament, it was rejected by the Kurds. And so right now we are in a state of an impasse where there is largely Sunni-Shia agreement on these amendments and what the Constitution should look like, and by extension, what the federal state should look like, but disagreement with along ethnic grounds. And I think your basic point is very well taken, that it has and will continue to impede progress, not just on, you know, the passage of specific pieces of legislation, but on a more generally speaking, a broad compact on what Iraq should look like going forward.
Rand, especially on the party discipline question.
Yes, but I do want to comment to Faisal on the issue of the constitutional legislation. You know probably more than anybody else here on this issue. I should mention that Faisal was instrumental in the writing of the TAL, the Transitional Administrative Law. But it seems to me that in the constitutional process, our pattern has been consistently to see the cart being put before the horse in Iraq on the legal issues. And it seems to me inconceivable how a provincial law can be passed before the Constitutional Review Committee has not only finished its work, but which it has not, but also that it has been approved by Parliament and the Constitution actually formally changed. Now, I should tell you that I don't think the CRC, there are certain issues it didn't even address because it couldn't, they were stymied. But even those issues that it did address, my personal view, I'm not a lawyer, but my layman's view is that it didn't do a very good job in any case. So on the party discipline, I don't know whether you're talking about the larger blocs, the UIA, the Tawafaq. If you are, then there is certainly a complete breakdown.
Even within the parties,
yes, there is, because the Sadris, for example, are not all in agreement. Even the parliamentary bloc of the Sadris are not in agreement with each other. The IIP, within the IIP, there are the hawks and the doves, and they don't always agree. We actually heard from certain IIP people that they did not necessarily agree with what Tariq al-Hashimi was doing. The Dawa party, I don't need to tell you that it's fragmented into at least three blocks now, or three smaller groups. Within the ISKI, it's very interesting because ISKI and Badr are now spoken about differently or separately. People now talk about the Badr group and the Supreme Council group. I was quite astonished to hear that. And I probed into that and I was told, yes, there were differences. So I think you are quite right about this. We don't know the extent of the differences. I certainly don't know how deep they are, but they do exist.
Dan, can I just
please,
on the constitutional question again, because Ren mentioned with regard to the provincial powers law, what we have is the cart before the horse. I think she's absolutely right. But really what we have is the cart before the horse.
Yes.
Because the constitutional review actually, even if the entire package of amendments were to be adopted and into the Constitution, does not address the relationship between the center and the provinces.
Right.
It is one of the issues that they punted on, just like they punted on it during the drafting of the Constitution in 2005. And I think what we have here, in terms of the cart before the horse, is a failure to even agree on fundamental principles of state to enshrine in the Constitution. And whether or not that's a function of the fact that in 2005 the Constitution was drafted in less than 6 weeks, without all the parties present at the table, and that there has never been, even since then, this fundamental agreement and understanding of what Iraq should look like, both in terms of, you know, regions, the structure of the state, should it be regions, should it be provinces, and then as between the center and the regions themselves, what should be the distribution of power, how devolved and decentralized should Iraq look. These questions have never been resolved conclusively. And frankly, at least particularly with regard to the structure of the state, and to an extent the distribution of power question, wouldn't be fully resolved even if the constitutional review were completed as it looks today. So I'll throw that out there.
I'll just register that while I agree with everything that Jason and Wren have said, I'm not so sure that putting the horse in front of the cart would be a very good idea right now. It would delay things, and I think Iraqis are learning how to work this out in practice rather than through constitutional amendments, and I think there might be some virtue in that.
I'm Ian Moss from the Center for American Progress.
And can you speak up and into the microphone, please?
I'm Ian Moss from the Center for American Progress, and my question concerns the SAQWA movement. Given that they played such a critical role in the reduction of violence, and their power at the local level has increased tremendously over the last year and a half, what steps are being taken by the central government to begin to integrate them into the ranks of the government? And as you all mentioned, there have been proposals to to integrate about 20,000 of these members. However, that still leaves about 50,000 potentially will be unemployed, idle hands. What steps are being taken to actually integrate them? And also, what did you all notice in terms of cohesion among different SAQWA groups, particularly given that they are seeking to extend their voice to the national level? Thank you.
Bryn, do you want to try that one? Well, I'd only say that the only real commitment is to 20%, and that 20% is probably 20% of the 110,000 that will eventually be in the CLCs, now called Sons of Iraq, and that 20% will go into the security forces, mainly the police, because a lot of these people don't want to be in the army, which would entail moving them all around the country. My sense of things was that this had happened really quite spontaneously, especially in Anbar, that the Americans had been smart enough and quick enough to take advantage of it, which was a good thing, that the government was still in particular, maybe the Prime Minister's office was still in a bit of shock that the Americans had put all these people on the payroll, and was trying to figure out what to do about it. I haven't seen very concrete plans, but maybe Wren knows more than I do.
Well, I think they have taken, when we were there, they had already taken 9,000, which seems like a very small figure. But they are committed to take 20%. But the larger issue really is, well, first of all, you're absolutely right. However many, even assuming the government takes all 20% that it has promised, that leaves 80,000 people or more. And this is where we come to the importance of getting this government moving, because unless they find jobs, unless they reactivate the economy, they are not going to be able to provide jobs. And my sense is that if these people do not within 6 months, and I think we said that in the paper, that if by June these people don't feel that they have jobs, that they have incomes, and the jobs are not just to give them money, the jobs are to keep them out of mischief. You want to get them off the streets, you want to get them going to work from 9 till 5 and so on and so forth. The larger issue that you mentioned is, what about the political integration of these SAQWAs? I was quite astonished that some people, very senior advisors to the Prime Minister, said, well, they're going to have provincial elections and they're going to be, you know, happy to rule their own little provinces and whatnot. Well, when we met with the SAQWA people, that wasn't their idea at all. They wanted to get into the politics of Baghdad. national politics. And so there was a discussion about bringing some of them into the cabinet, which is supposed to be reconstituted. They talk about this for months and months and months. They come closer to it from time to time. And there are suggestions. But somebody has to give up seats in order to get the Sahwa into the cabinet. So there are problems with dealing with the Sahwa. And I think the Shia parties are very scared even about bringing the 20% into the army, because they're afraid of what could happen with this 20% in the army. It'll change the complexion of the army and so on. So there's some issues.
I would only add that they're also terribly afraid of what happens if they don't do something with these people.
Yes, and I
would add a word on the economic issue of job creation. Anybody who has talked with the Iraqi government lately, I think, has grave doubts about whether this government can create jobs. But my discussion with people who know Anbar well suggests that Anbar is calm, that money is flowing in, and that we may be a little surprised at the number of jobs created, not by the government, but largely by private initiative in Anbar. And that would be a very, very good thing. Now, that doesn't solve the Baghdad problem, because in Baghdad you have a sectarian mosaic. You don't have a single group that's clearly dominant. And though more and more the Shia are dominant in Baghdad, it's still a mosaic. And I think if Anbar had some success in creating private sector jobs, that would be a very positive thing for Iraq overall. Bob?
Hey, yeah, good morning. I'm Bob Dreyfus, writing for The Nation and some other magazines. It's a real pleasure to hear people finally talking about Iraqi politics like it really means something, which is such a relief from the kind of, well, anyway, ignorance and arrogance of American policy over the last 5 years. I remember sitting in black coffee briefings at AEI in 2002 and 2003 and hearing the Michael Rubins of the world talk about how, well, Iraq will no longer be an Arab country, and maybe we, you know, things like that. We can decouple it from the Arab League and everything. So my question is about the consistent problem in this country has been underestimating Arab nationalism, something I've been writing about for the last couple of years, Iraqi nationalism in Iraq. And I know there's been a little talk about that this morning, but I'd like to hear more about that. As I just spent the last couple of weeks interviewing all these McCain people about what their views are for the future of Iraq, and it's, you know, a permanent American presence, and Iraq is going to be the anchor for an American military role in the region for years and years to come, 100 years, McCain says. So my question is, this July agreement with Maliki, are the Iraqi nationalists going to really stand for this? I mean, are they going to roll over if Maliki signs an agreement with Bush? Can these ridiculous separatists like ISKI and the Kurds and Maliki get that through the parliament in a way that works? Or is there going to be a resistance in Iraq to this accord that the United States is trying to ram down their throats?
I think it obviously depends on what's in the agreement. But, Ren, did you want to respond on the question of Iraqi Arab nationalists?
Well, I thought you were the sofa guy. A lot depends on what's in that agreement. And remember that the sort of letter of intent that was signed, I can't remember, when was it? Was actually signed with the agreement of all the parties, including ISKI, including, I think the Sadris may have had problem with it, but certainly including the Sunnis. There's going to be a lot of hard bargaining, and it may be something that has to go to the Iraqi parliament. It remains to be seen whether it'll go to the US Senate. That's going to be an interesting question. But commenting on Iraqi nationalism, my sense is that it is always with the exception of the Kurds. But the Kurds, by the way, I wouldn't say that the Kurdish Grand Alliance is breaking down by any means. But the Kurds are becoming much more nuanced. When you read the Kurdish scene, there are differences there. And we didn't go into that today because that's not our topic. But I think the sense of Iraqiness is on the upswing. And people who say that there is no national identity are wrong. The problem is that each political party thinks it is Iraq. You know, the Supreme Council talks about Iraq as if it is, Iraq was all it, or it was the best for Iraq. The Sahwa now are talking definitely as if they represent the best interest of Iraq. None of them is saying we want to have nothing to do with Iraq and we couldn't care less and we don't think of ourselves Iraqi. The opposite is true. Now, Dan mentioned, we felt we were told that there was a lot of bottom-up pressure on politicians to focus on this Iraqiness. And I don't think it's that they didn't want to, but they feel that they need to do so more now.
I would just say that my guess is that the process of negotiating this agreement will be an interesting test on both sides.
Okay. I'd actually like to follow up on the SOFA question and say that...
But first you have to introduce yourself,
Jared. Jared Blanc from Open Society Institute. And I'd like to follow up a little bit on the SOFA question and ask, so you say that it depends on what's in the agreement, whether or not the Council of Representatives will be able to pass it, which of course makes a lot of sense. I wonder if you could give us a little bit more of a shape of what might be able to come through the Council of Representatives, and particularly given last week's and the week before announcement from Secretaries Rice and Gates that backing up a little bit from some of the commitments that the U.S. had made in the Declaration of Principles, what is it that the U.S. can offer in these negotiations, since essentially the public position of our government now is we are asking for commitments from the Iraqi government and offering few in return. Thank you.
Well, my personal view is that the requirements of Iraqi politicians for establishing sovereignty over U.S. forces and private security companies is diametrically opposed to American political requirements that the U.S. forces at least be kept under U.S. sovereign control. And so I don't see how they're going to resolve that issue. I'd almost bet on it not being resolved, and that's a real problem because without a UN Security Council resolution and without a SOFA, you don't have a legal basis on which American troops can be present in Iraq and be assured of what the course of action will be if they do wrong. And that's a real problem, it seems to me. Now, I've heard some people say, well, that can be fudged, don't worry about it, but I can hear what the Pentagon lawyers are going to say. They're not going to want that fudged. Please, Phoebe.
Phoebe Moore, scholar on Iraq. Mike, it's a question, and I'd like Rend and perhaps Dan to ruminate on. Needless to say, I was very heartened to hear you talk about the breakdown of these sectarian alliances and something approaching more normal parties, and that is a trend, of course, we would like to encourage. But one of my fears is that when we go into provincial elections, which we, of course, have to have at some point, and I agree in unmixed areas, for example, it might be a Shia on Shia or Sunni on Sunni struggle, might not entirely be either. What about mixed areas? Baghdad, Diyala, Nineveh. One of the things we saw in 2005 was that in the absence of strong parties who are going to compete on the basis of interests and constituencies, programs, whatever, people fall back on sectarian identity. We've just seen another similar example in Kenya. These elections all seem to be getting back to existential identities, which is precisely the trend we don't want to encourage. And incidentally, of course, one of the main players in all of this was Sistani. In 2005, we had a wonderful discussion, and he's not been mentioned and so on. But I would just, do you see this as a potential, what shall we say, unpleasant outcome of the election. How would you evaluate that? And particularly these parties who want to prove that they are the real Iraq, whether they're Sunni or Shia or whatever. Is there anything we can do at all to help mitigate that?
Yeah, Phoebe, of course, you, as always, you put your finger on a very sore subject and a very important one. First of all, with the provincial elections, I think it's essential, and with the national elections, if we... one important thing that really needs to be done is to get away from this closed list system and either have individual candidates running or open lists where people can choose their candidates. And you're absolutely right that when push comes to shove, in the climate of distrust, at best distrust, between Sunnis and Shia, and I emphasize right at the start of my speech that this still exists, let's not fool ourselves, that people will fall back on primordial allegiances and so on. But I think in mixed areas what might happen, and if we take Baghdad as an exemplar, we may see people not voting for a UIA, but Shia voting for the Sadris or the Supreme Council or the Dawah or indeed some other Shia group that may emerge. So the Shia may still vote for Shia, but for competing Shia parties. And I think the same may happen in amongst the Sunnis, that they may vote for the IIP or for the CLCs and so on and so forth. So, and that is already better than what we had before. The problem is that realistically there are no alternatives right now. What is the alternative? If you had elections tomorrow, what alternatives do Iraqis have other than the sect-based or ethnically-based parties? There aren't. There's only Iyad Alawi's, and it's very weak. I don't know how much of the vote they will capture. They will probably capture more in Baghdad than anywhere else, because they depend on a sort of an educated, upper-middle-class elite. But that is not where the maximum votes are. So, yes, I think we will still go back to voting on ethnicity and sect, first of all because of the absence of alternatives, secondly because you always fall back on what you trust most and what you fear most. This is one of the issues that is going to arise in Baghdad and is going to arise in Diyala for the Sunnis is the question of the IDPs and the refugees. It's particularly the refugees, because the Sunnis lost big time in Baghdad. And most of the exodus from Baghdad has been by Sunnis. So the Sunnis see themselves very diminished in Baghdad, and yet Baghdad is really their, it's not their stronghold in the sense that they're a majority, but historically, culturally, politically, that has been their big place. And to lose massive population, they're already talking about the forced demographic changes in Baghdad, and they're talking about this as being ethnic cleansing by the Shia. They are going to want to find a real solution to get votes back in Baghdad. And I don't know how this is going to be addressed between now and October if we do have provincial elections in Baghdad.
Jason?
No, I think the one point that I would underscore is open lists would go a long way towards breaking down not necessarily the sectarian nature of elections in Iraq, but the party hold on the members, particularly in the national government. The fact that, you know, parliamentarians are not beholden to local citizens at all. They're only there by the good grace of their party leaders. And so if you want to try and break down this apparatus, I think that is the first place to start, to be sure.
Yeah. Rahman.
Rahman Jaburi, Net. I'll make it short, actually. With Dan, I don't agree that BRT is a success. And I've been 4.5 years ago. I mean, in Iraq, I just came back. I think it is for the sake of the people here, if you elaborate on why local government is not good at this point. And I do 100% agree with you, but I need more the audience has, why is that it's not good. For Jason, passing a lot of laws right now in the Iraqi parliament, myself, I think it is really a big disaster, because we're talking about putting laws, there is no implementation at all. We're creating more problem, a lot of problem created by these laws, like the budget, the professional council, even the amnesty. These are laws creating problem in the future. So how can we create laws that get us more trouble? And for Rand, please.
Do you want me to go first?
Yeah.
And Rahman, thank you. I would add to that the recently passed debathification law as well, which may be the most problematic in the implementation of all four of them, although provincial powers will certainly see its share of challenges. I think you're absolutely right, and I tried when addressing these laws to distinguish between the letter of the law itself and to outline where I think that they are potentially positive, and the implementation, which is always the key, particularly in Iraq, and that will remain the case. I think that the laws that were passed have the potential to be positive steps towards broader national reconciliation and accommodation. I absolutely do, looking at the letter of the law. Let's look at, since we haven't discussed debathification, let's look at that. Debathification has the potential to return upwards of 38,000 Sunnis to civil service. It also frees up another 11 or 12,000 people that were formerly denied pension benefits and makes them eligible to receive pension benefits even if they're not allowed to return to work. Okay, that's great as far as it goes, but we've already discussed the inability of the Iraqi government to create jobs. And that's certainly the case even within the civil ministry. And even if to the extent that there are jobs, they've been, they've been filled with other individuals. So how many of these 38,000 potential returnees are going to have a job ready for them? Let's look at the pension system. It's largely dysfunctional, even with the current rolls. I think it's operating at around 40%. And now you want to add another 12,000 people to it. The impact of the debathification law, and by extension I would say all these other three laws as well, will be in the ability of the government to effectuate it and to do so positively. And you are absolutely right that if they are unable to do so, it will have a net negative effect, because it will just again emphasize the failure of the national government to accomplish anything, and will lower confidence on the average Iraqi in their government. That risk is absolutely there, and I agree with you completely. And the only thing I would say is that I think, in addition to the laws themselves, I would not overlook the importance of the process that was reached in passing these three laws last week. And I think what we saw there was not only a creative mechanism to get around the mistrust that I spoke of earlier, but also the ability to see beyond discrete events, discrete issues. That's something that has not happened previously in Iraq to date. And I believe is a roadmap for solving future problems as well. And I think that's enormously important. Again, it's not enough to pass legislation. We absolutely agree on that. But I believe that this legislation has the potential to deliver positive results. And as always the case, the devil will be in the implementation.
Rand?
Thanks, Rahman. There are many reasons why I don't think it's very practical, but let me try and concentrate on a few. One of them has to do with the resources of the United States. And it seems to me that we have limited human resources, limited expertise. The PRTs I have met, I don't have as long an experience with the PRTs as Rahman has had, but the PRTs have a lot of goodwill, but they're short on people with experience and with maturity to do the job, and they're there for a year and then they're out and then somebody new comes by the time they learn the terrain. We do not have enough resources to build up 18 governorates simultaneously, or even 15, and the national government as well. We don't have the capacity, we don't have the people to do it, we don't have the systems to do it. And we have to be selective. Therefore, if we are going to be selective, what should we do? Do we choose 5 governorates and ignore all the rest? What is the process? And this is why I think, you know, it's better to think of the national government first. The other reason is that the provincial governorates have proven... The national government, of course, is corrupt, full of graft, open to nepotism and domination by single parties. The provincial governorates are even more so. They are unbelievably incompetent, controlled by single parties, or fight amongst each other. They all appoint their relatives, they all steal the money. I have to go back to what Dan said, and Dan, I hate to disagree with you. May it never happen again. But you talk about the Ambar. The Ambar are doing a good job, not because the Provincial Council of Ambar is doing a good job. It's because U.S. money is going to contractors in Ambar to do particular jobs. It's not because the Ambar Council is so efficient, so dedicated, and so clean that it knows how to contract and supervise projects and so on. That ain't so. Okay. I also want to say that in Iraq, the needs are so humongous, the job creation needs and so on, that a certain level of national strategic planning needs to be done. It could then be devolved to the governorates and so on, but the central government, the national government, has to think strategically and to plan strategically for the country, because the needs are enormous. And I don't think it can happen piecemeal over 18 governorates. Remember, the Kurds have had 15 years in which to do this, and they've made a great deal of made big strides, but they're not there yet. There are still serious problems, economic, infrastructure, and structural problems in Kurdistan. And finally, there is the historic element of people still looking to the national government, and it is going to be very hard to win them. We have a time lapse issue, that people have needs. The provincial governorates are not responding to those needs. The people look to the national government. Right now, the national government is not responding to the needs. We have to hurry up and fulfill those needs. We have to respond to them. What is the best way and the quickest way to respond to them? These are just some of the reasons that I'm giving, and I have, you know, there are others. There are others about who's going to control the army. We are a country that needs to protect borders. We need to fight Al-Qaeda. We need to fight terrorists. We need to fight insurgents. And we now have 550,000 ISF, in Iraqi
security
forces. Okay, allegedly 550. Yet the national government can't get enough troops to one governorate in order to chase the remnants of Al-Qaeda. How can we fight the insurgency and terrorism and secure our borders with a weak, incompetent government? It's a contradiction in terms.
Well, I stand accused of thinking that PRTs are successful and of thinking that provincial governments are clean and efficient. I don't believe either one. I did say that I thought PRTs had been successful in helping to push money from the central level down to the provincial level and getting some projects done, and I think that's true. I differ from Rand a little bit in believing, and this is a matter of degree between us, not of absolutes, in believing that decentralization is part of the solution in Iraq. And it's the reason I don't follow her entirely in wanting to focus very heavily on the central government. There, you can't solve Iraq's problems, which are zero sum, at the national level. It's true that Iraq needs an army, needs to guard its borders, all of those things, and I think we're providing very ample support in those directions. But I do think that decentralization is absolutely essential in enlarging the pie, and enabling Iraqis to see their politics as not a zero-sum game. So I think some modicum of programmatic competence and expenditure at the provincial level is a good thing. It distinguishes the Iraq of the future from Saddam's Iraq, and I think that's a good thing as well. And frankly, it's more in keeping with a democratic society than the highly centralized Iraq of yesteryear, which simply can't be restored because people don't have enough confidence in the central government. I don't think the provincial governments are competitive with the central government. I think they're complementary. I'm going to go back through us. Jason, anything you want to add at the end?
Only that don't ever apologize for being an optimist, Dan.
Ren?
Well, I just want to comment on your last words. I am in favor of decentralization. I just do not want it to be at the expense of the national government and to make the national government irrelevant.
I would just want to add a word on the question of the American presence, which Bob Dreyfus asked about. I think he may have left. No, there he is. We said in our written report what we heard, which was that Iraqis are interested in a time horizon. They're not interested in immediate withdrawal. If they could vote in American elections, they would all vote for the candidate who makes the most unconditional commitment to staying in Iraq as long as possible, and that's Mr. McCain. But they are not interested in seeing America stay in Iraq forever. They just want the least conditional presence and would like to be in control of whether we stay or not. And that seems to me to be quite a legitimate desire on that part. As for American intentions, I actually find this harder to read on this subject than the Iraqis are. You're quite right. The Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense were really backpedaling pretty fast on what had originally been a pretty grand conception of this agreement, having realized that in its grander form it had to go to the Senate for advice and consent, and for ratification actually, and in its lesser form it might go as an executive agreement. That said, I think you have to trust the process. These are two sovereign states who are going to deal with each other, and we've embarked on a negotiation. We're going to have to see how far we can get with it. My guess is that the grander form of this is going to prove impossible. I'm not even sure whether the narrower form is going to prove possible, because there are some political requirements on both sides that are 180 degrees opposite from each other. But, I believe in the negotiating process, and it's a good thing that we'll be doing this. Just, it represents an enormous restoration of sovereignty for us even to agree to engage in this negotiation. So I see it as a positive step, even if the result by July isn't as glorious as some people might hope. I want to thank you all, and I want to thank the other two-thirds of the panel for a good 2 hours of discussion of Iraq. Thanks.